Harp. I'm here with Edwin Aralisa. We'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
When you say we, are you going to divide your time?
Well, primarily the arguments that were accepted by the commissioner are the ones that I will handle. There are some fallback issues that the court may wish to inquire of Mr. Aralisa, so he is here to jump in if those questions arise. I won't be handling the issues that he's dealing with.
Well, we usually have one person up here at a time, so I suggest that you sit down, and if we call on you, then you can come forward, identify yourself, and say what you're going to do. But we're going to be looking to Mr. Karp to manage this argument.
Okay. All right. Then 3 minutes rebuttal, please.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. May it please the court, we're here today seeking reversal of the conviction of Ms. Norman, who is with us, as well as the release of her dog, Duncan, who's been held at the Seattle Animal Shelter for 1 year, over 8 months to date. I think a good place to begin is the testimony of Officer Leahy in trial, and I'll just read briefly here. She testified that I advised the defendant that she had a couple of options, that she could remove the dog from the city limits, or if she kept the dog at her residence in the city limits, the city may pursue criminal charges against her. She was not ordered to remove the dog. She was not given a directive. She received nothing in writing. She was just given options that might or might not result in prosecution. That is hardly in compliance with the pre-charge procedure that's established by the Seattle Code at section 925035. And that also amounts to a complete failure of proof of a key element. So the criminal charge here is based on a knowingly owning a dangerous animal, or keeping a dangerous animal in reckless disregard of the fact that the animal is dangerous. But epistemologically, how do we know something? How does Ms. Norman know that her dog is dangerous, unless the dog is declared as such? And again, the City of Seattle Code articulates the very procedure that the Director of Animal Control, within his discretion, may declare an animal dangerous.
If I have a pit bull and it escapes and goes into the neighbor's yard and kills two young children, do I need a declaration from the city before I know that dog's dangerous?
I think there are other facts. The definition of dangerous...
You said you need a declaration before you know a dog is dangerous. That's not necessarily the case, is it?
I believe that a structural reading of the code anticipates that there will first be a preliminary determination, an opportunity to meet and confer, and that determination begins with...
In my hypothetical, then, you would need a notice under your reading and epistemology, need a notice before you knew that your dog was dangerous.
Yes. There are other factors.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe your client was convicted under a criminal statute that says a dangerous animal is an animal that, when unprovoked, inflicts severe injury on or kills a human being, et cetera. So setting aside when unprovoked, which is a different part of your argument, the fact that this dog inflicted a gash on... what's the victim's name? Mrs. Grant? At any rate, the person who was bitten, 50 stitches. And so doesn't the ordinary person know when a dog does that the dog has inflicted severe injury and therefore meets the definition of dangerous animal for the criminal statute?
I don't think so. And the reason is that the definition of severe injury is further defined by the code to require proof of disfigurement. The city chose the word disfiguring for a reason, to distinguish disfiguring from non-disfiguring injuries that require medical treatment. The fact that she required medical treatment and stitches is understood.
So now you're arguing that there's insufficient evidence to support the conviction because there's insufficient evidence of disfigurement?
I wasn't trial counsel, but I believe that that is...
Is that your argument now? Because I wasn't really aware that that was your argument.
That's not the fundamental argument. It's simply another point that there needs to be notice given articulating why the city is declaring the dog dangerous and changing his status so that the owner has the ability to either contest it in a de novo review before an examiner or to remove the dog if there actually is going to be a threat of the death of the dog. That's what we're dealing with here.
Does the trial record include any photographs of the injury?
I am not sure. I know that there is a photograph that I've seen that is from the inside of her forearm, a single cut. I mean, I don't know if you want me to go too far into disfigurement, but I read disfigurement as removal of a nose.
Well, not if it's not your argument. I mean, your argument, apparently, your main argument is you think that as a matter of law, the city, it has an administrative procedure, which you think the city has to go through before it can go to a criminal procedure. That's
exactly.
Your argument. Okay, and what is the main case that you think supports your argument? I mean, I guess you've got two arguments. One, you think it's read that way. As a matter of statutory construction. And
right.
Secondly, you think it violates the privileges and immunities
exactly.
clause. Exactly. So we can read it, but what about the privileges and immunities clause? Can you articulate that argument?
Sure. So, Your Honor, the question here is whether the city is making an end run around an administrative procedure that has a number of safeguards in order to execute a woman's dog and to convict her with a gross misdemeanor, whereas the administrative process at least gives discretion in disposition, the ability to remove the dog from the city limits and or placed, I suppose, within city limits in a secure animal shelter. The question for the court is whether that penalty is criminal in nature and whether there is an inappropriate exertion of discretion that results in these disparate penalties yet arising from the same operative facts.
Would you be making the same argument or a similar argument if there was no administrative process? Suppose the only thing on the books was criminal charges if your dog attacks and bites somebody severely.
I don't
Are
believe
you saying that,
that
even the, then that there would have to be yes. the statute would fail because it lacked an administrative process?
And the reason is state law, which the city of Seattle invokes in 925035. So state law 1608080 articulates a default administrative procedure that provides due process virtually the same as the one that is articulated in the city code. So I would say if the city was silent in terms of providing some sort of predetermination procedure, then they would be bound by state law and its process. It's meet and confer opportunity before there's a final determination, and then the opportunity to contest that in an evidentiary hearing where the city bears the burden. So either way, they do. The other aspect that I would simply note here is that even when a dog is declared dangerous under the city code, if you note, 3 out of 4 of the sub-definitions all presume that there is some notice given in writing. 2 findings, 2 convictions, whether it's within or without the jurisdiction of Seattle, there is some advance notice. There is some opportunity to be heard at least twice before the animal is deemed dangerous and the criminal conviction befalls the owner. I believe the rest of the briefing speaks to the key issues. I'm out of time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Green. I'm an assistant city attorney, and I represent the city respondent, City of Seattle, in this case. The first issue that the defendant raises is whether Seattle's animal control ordinance provides that the only way of determining that a dog is dangerous is through an administrative declaration by the director. It is a fundamental issue in any sort of statutory construction question that the goal is to determine the intent of the legislative body. It's our position that the Seattle City Council did not intend to make that the only means by which an animal could be declared dangerous for 3 reasons. First of all, the ordinance that gives the director that authority does not expressly state that that is the exclusive means of declaring a dog to be dangerous. Second, the ordinance defining the crime of owning a dangerous animal doesn't make any reference to an administrative determination of dangerousness. And third, the City Council knew how to create a crime that relied on an administrative declaration because in SMC 925083B creates the crime of possessing an animal in the city after it had been ordered removed by the director pursuant to that administrative authority. So again, the City Council knew how to create a crime that relied on a declaration of dangerousness if they wanted to do so, and I think they intentionally chose not to. So it's our position that the defendant has not established that the ordinance itself provides that the only means of declaring a dog to be dangerous is through the administrative process. The next question would be whether due process requires that administrative determination that a dog is dangerous precede a criminal charge of owning a dangerous animal. Again, because the ordinance itself doesn't require that, the defendant plainly is challenging the constitutionality of the ordinance. And again, an ordinance is presumed to be constitutional. It's our position that the standard to be applied is set forth in Medina against California, that a state law governing criminal procedure does not violate due process unless it offends some principle of justice so rooted in the traditions and conscience of our people as to be ranked as fundamental. In the Rabin cases, both here and in the Supreme Court, the courts considered a defendant who had been convicted under this ordinance without any previous administrative determination that the dogs were vicious. And although I realize that really wasn't the issue in those cases, the court never said anything suggesting that that process was unconstitutional. And it would seem to me that if this prior administrative determination is part of if it's a fundamental principle of justice, you would think that the courts would have said something about that in those cases, which again involved a criminal conviction for owning a vicious animal without any administrative determination preceding that. I think the defendant's reliance on the Bash case is misplaced because it was the ambiguous language of the statute itself that suggested that an administrative determination of the dog's dangerousness or potential dangerousness was an element of the crime, in which case that administrative determination would necessarily have to precede a criminal charge. I think the cases that the out-of-state cases that the city has cited in our brief also stand for the proposition that the Constitution, at least due process, does not require an administrative determination that a dog is dangerous before its owner can be charged with owning a dangerous animal.
Let me ask you to turn your attention to another issue that the commissioner did not necessarily grant discretionary review on, but it's going to be up to this court whether or not we examine it. And that is this issue of Officer Jackson testifying that Duncan's bite was unprovoked. You would agree, I take it, that it was the city's burden to prove that the bite was unprovoked.
Yes.
And the city had a problem in that the victim was not present to testify, and there was nobody else there that had actually seen the incident.
Correct.
And so the way that the city chose to address that problem was by having Officer Jackson offer the opinion. Isn't that how it came in? It was his opinion that it was unprovoked.
No, I guess I need to back up. There was another person present during the incident, and that was the defendant. And I think
right.
So, and I think the testimony of the defendant's reaction after the incident, in terms of talking to the victim's mother, didn't suggest that she was claiming that the bite was provoked. I think she made a statement to the officer, the first officer who, I think it was Officer Jackson, who investigated.
Is it sufficient to establish that the attack was unprovoked, that she didn't make a claim that it was?
Well, I think the totality of the circumstantial evidence was sufficient, and I don't.
Well, let's get into this kind of closely here. I mean, Mrs. Norman didn't testify either, right?
Correct.
So the only person that we've got that can establish unprovoked is Officer Jackson's testimony. Now, I have the transcript here. I'm just going to read it here, if you don't mind. The court at first is reluctant to have him talk about that this bite is unprovoked, and then the court changes its mind and says it's going to allow it, and then you can ask it again. So then what did you tell the defendant about this bite, Officer Jackson? I told her this bite was an unprovoked bite. And how did she react when you told her that? She said, after explaining it, she said she understood. Okay, now how does that amount to substantive testimony, affirmative testimony, testimony with evidentiary value that the bite was unprovoked?
Well, I don't. Again, I think it's not so much that evidence, but the other evidence that when Officer Jackson, when the victim's mother testified that when she I guess, her reaction to the incident when it happened was the circumstantial evidence showing that it was an unprovoked bite. I mean, she made statements that, oh, my God, he has never done anything like that. She was visibly upset. She was apologetic. She, after the incident, came over to check on the condition of the victim. She also advised her not to file a lawsuit and not to appear if the city pursued charges. That would sort of suggest some sort of guilty conscience, at least, about her liability for this dog attack.
How so exactly? I mean, she, you know, the, you have to show it. It isn't her burden to come forward and say that that Mrs. Grant, is that the victim's name?
Yes, I think so.
Provoked the dog. She didn't have to prove that.
That's correct.
The city had to prove that it was unprovoked. And, of course, the logical way to do that would be to call Mrs. Grant, but she wasn't there. So you're trying to somehow make the fact that the defendant acted guilty serve as proof, meeting the city's burden of proof that the attack was unprovoked. I mean, couldn't a person feel guilty about a dog bite even if the victim did something to provoke it? It was a pretty bad bite.
I suppose that's possible, again, but it's again, I would just say that it's the totality of the circumstantial evidence that established that the bite was unprovoked. Also, I don't think the defendant has challenged on appeal the sufficiency of the evidence. They've challenged, I mean, that bite.
Well, it's an opinion. I mean, that's the challenge, right? It's an improper opinion testimony that the dog was unprovoked, allowing to serve.
Right. I mean,
whether an officer has the ability whether it's legitimate for the officer to come in and offer an opinion on an element of the crime is the heatly question.
I guess, again, it's our position that the officer's testimony was based, it was not certainly not an opinion on the defendant's guilt. It was not an opinion on anybody's veracity. It was based on his experience and the information that he had. He was making an evaluation of the situation in order to give the defendant
How would you distinguish this from an officer expressing an opinion on what the defendant intended to do with the chemicals found in his car?
Again, I think that goes to a specific person's state of mind. And see, this we're talking about dog.
We're talking about a dog's specific state of mind. Aren't we?
I don't know. I don't know what if there are different rules regarding an animal's state of mind versus a person's state of mind, but I think your example clearly involves a defendant's state of mind, and I don't think that is not what Officer Jackson was.
Well, he's offering an opinion on the dog's behavior and Mrs. Grant's behavior. I mean, he's basically saying Mrs. Grant, in my opinion, didn't do anything to provoke Duncan. So therefore, guilt.
Well, I mean, I think, I guess I don't think he was, I do not agree that he was offering any sort of opinion as to Ms. Grant's state of mind. He might have been offering
Mrs. Grant's conduct.
Right. He might have been offering, I mean, again, based on the information that he had and his experience telling the defendant what the situation was and what her options are going to be. So I think that was The point of it was not to offer an opinion on anybody's guilt or state of mind, but just his evaluation based on the information that he had and his experience as to what the situation involved.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, what's wrong with this timer? Because it didn't make a sound. But I think you had 3 minutes remaining. Is that correct? Okay. Go ahead, and you may introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Edwin Arelis. I work for the King County Department of Public Defense, and I briefed the two issues for the confrontation issue and the opinion. I'd first ask the court to accept review and then ask the court to reverse Ms. Norman's conviction. Let me begin by saying this, that biting, when Duncan bit Ms. Grant, that did not mean that Ms. Norman was guilty of this particular crime of owning a dangerous dog.
Was this tried to a jury?
Yes. So biting was not the critical fact. Well, I think the critical fact in this case at the trial was whether or not it was a provoked versus unprovoked bite. And the legal definitions of jury instructions instructed the jury that this is the critical issue, and that's what trial counsel had argued. Ultimately, Ms. Norman did not know that Duncan was dangerous from the legal definition because Officer Leahy never told her that Duncan was dangerous. I mean, obviously, biting somebody is a concern, but legally, Ms. Norman did not know that Duncan was dangerous, and that's a critical issue because...
Apart from the officer's testimony, was there sufficient evidence to establish that this was an unprovoked bite?
I don't think so. And the reason why is there were four witnesses who the city did not call. Ms. Coleman, the victim's mother, did not testify at the trial. And I don't think the record is as clear that Ms. Norman saw exactly what happened. What Officer Jackson testified to is that Ms. Norman told him that someone came to the home unannounced, knocked on the door. Duncan ran past her, and then she heard screaming and yelling. But I don't think the record is completely clear that Ms. Norman actually saw Duncan bite Ms. Grant. And Ms. Grant's actions in those split seconds, I think, were as missing because there was no independent evidence of that. And therefore, that's why Officer Jackson's testimony in regards to the opinion that this was an unprovoked attack is so damaging and needs reversal in this particular situation. The other issue in regards to the opinion is that I know the city cited the Nelson case, and that is, I would argue that the Alameda case is more on point in the sense that there are limits to opinion evidence under Evidence Rule 701 and 704. And the issue here is Officer Jackson's testimony that this is unprovoked crosses that limit because now we're talking about the...
That wouldn't be a constitutional argument, though. That would simply be an argument under the rules of evidence. But allowing the officer to give his opinion is a constitutional argument.
Yes, it's one way of looking at it, absolutely.
Do you take the position that he was actually expressing a formal opinion as to provocation?
Yes, I think he was, absolutely, based upon the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. That concludes our docket for this morning. Court will be at recess.
All rise.